Hello, and thanks for listening. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I spoke with Professor Eric Mugler about his new book, Songs of Dead Parents, Corpse, Text, and World in Southwest China. Eric is professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan, and this new book is the product of sustained, decades-long research with a community in Southwest China's Yunnan province. The book examines, in particular, how the Lolopo, a community officially identified as part of China's Yi minority ethnic group, work on the dead through a variety of rituals, oral traditions, and material practices. This poor explanation hardly does justice to the complexity of these practices and their importance to this group. So please listen on to this fascinating conversation as Eric explains it far more eloquently than I ever could.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, an occasional podcast featuring interviews with the authors of the latest monographs in the field of East Asian Studies. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the channel, and today I'm delighted to be joined by renowned anthropologist and sinologist Eric Mugler to discuss his new book, Songs of Dead Parents. Eric is professor of anthropology at University of Michigan. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. So first off, Eric, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get started in anthropology in Southwest China?
I guess I started late. I went to China for the first time after graduating from college. I had a friend who got me a job teaching English in Xiamen, in Fujian. And during the breaks, I traveled a lot. And I suppose I just really liked the western part of China better than any other part, and ended up back in graduate school hoping to do a PhD thesis on, well, I'm not quite sure on what. I mean, it certainly wasn't on ethnicity, but I was interested in the sort of Tibeto-Burman speaking people in Yunnan and Sichuan. And I think the thesis was supposed to be originally about sort of the civilizing process, if you will, how these places kind of were, I suppose you might say, colonized. And, you know, it was a long road. So it took me a long time, really, to get permission to work anywhere. I had identified Yizhu as people that seemed really interesting to me. And I think that there was just a lot of thrashing around. I mean, this was some time ago. It was the late 80s before we had very much an English about any of these Tibeto-Burman speaking people. And I don't know. I started out doing a little bit of preliminary field work actually near Lijiang, and not with Yizhu at all, but, you know, in a little nashi place that my friend Chaz McCann had suggested I go to. And I met some Nosu, which are one of the people who are called Yi in China there. And they just seemed so kind of interestingly different from other people I was meeting. And so after meeting them, I came back and wrote a proposal to work with Nosu. And that didn't really work out. I wasn't allowed to go to, well, yeah, I wasn't really allowed to go to any of the places either in Yunnan or Sichuan where Nosu were living. Instead, I got a grant from, gosh, this is turning into a long story, Tim. So anyway, I ended up working with these folks who really no one had any interest in a place, a county called Yongren, which is in the northern part of Yunnan, but not the Northwest, which is beautiful and touristy and everything, but just completely undistinguished mountains. People who call themselves Lolopo. And I ended up there just as a series of kind of mistakes, really, but was very fortunate to end up in a community where people took me on as their own kind of project, actually. So that's kind of how I got started.
Oh, that's great. I feel like the best fieldwork stories sort of start like that, with that sort of series of accidents that end up taking you to a good place.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're lucky. Yeah. And I was very lucky.
So I guess one of the things that stood out to me at the beginning was that this is your second project, your second book your third book overall, but your second with this particular community. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the process of writing a second book with the same community, because I feel like that's not something that everybody does in our fields.
It's definitely different than writing a first kind of ethnography about a community. If that's what, you know, you imagine anthropologists, and I'm an anthropologist, as you said, to do is, you know, like there's this basically rite of passage that allows us into the discipline, and that's doing a term of fieldwork of a year or more, and then writing an ethnography on a topic about a people. And you know, I suppose the biggest difference was there were two big differences. One was this second project was more focused on a specific set of problems and issues on death ritual, and set aside many of the bigger and more amorphous questions that I had been challenged by in my first project. And the second difference is distance. The second project was based in part on fieldwork I had done for the first project, and in part on fieldwork done during a series of visits over the years after that. And, you know, doing the first ethnography on this community, I was really immersed in the place. And then part of, you know, the process of writing the ethnography had to do with, you know, finding a way to kind of inhabit, you know, my new circumstances of being a graduate student and then a scholar in the United States, in a place where like everything that one could say about this place simply needed some kind of translation or some kind of filtering, because it's otherwise it was simply couldn't be understood. And so that were sort of the conditions of the first project, and the conditions of the second one were not so much, they were more distant and more, I suppose that distance, you know, it was both good and bad. It gave me the capacity to do a different kind of analysis. Perhaps because I wasn't as close, many of the kind of issues of kind of everyday life that were really present for people in the community maybe faded out of this second project.
I mean, that's a really fascinating sort of way of describing it. And so one of the ways you talk about this project is you say it's, or that a phrase that keeps on appearing is you talk about Lolopo, this community's work on the dead, is sort of what this book sort of deals with. Now, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what you mean by this.
Say, as a Westerner, as an American, my own ways of understanding or dealing with the dead have to do with, like, basically dead people might have a kind of existence for me, certainly do, actually, my own intimate dead in my mind as, you know, as figures from the past and possibly, you know, I mean, they have a presence and they have an existence in the presence and they affect my life. Yet I'm not called upon to do much to them or with them other than the mourning process. And once the mourning process is over, then there's remembering, but there's not active, I'm not called upon to do active, sustained work to shape, to maintain and shape my relations with them. And the contrast is that in this community, this community of Lolpo people, people who speak a language they call Longo, and who have their own sort of cultural resources that are quite different from most of the people around them, similar to other people called Yi in many ways, but very different from Han, very different from Tibetans. In this community, people really are called upon to actively, in a sustained way, work on and with dead people. And it's thinking about this work that people were doing on and with dead people that caused me to shift in thinking about dead people from like imaginary presences that have an effect in people's lives to, you know, basically people that are analogous to living people in so many ways, and to thinking about all the ritualized activity and ritualized language that people use with the dead as the mediating processes that are similar in many ways to the mediations that shape our relations with living people. Another aspect of work on the dead is that dead people have a great deal of power. Dead ancestors, of course, you know, and throughout this region are the source of life. Dead people who are not ancestors have a great deal of power to disrupt life and to disturb things. Work on the dead is what's required to manage that immense power and to, you know, to make sure that, you know, dead ancestors don't turn into other kinds of dead people like ghosts, to cultivate dead ancestors in the way that you would maybe cultivate crops so that they do provide one with health and a livelihood, and a good, I suppose, a good body and a good mind, all of those things. Work on the dead is also a kind of way to describe an immense amount of ritual that also connects living people with each other as they assemble into groups and communities that are intended to shape relationships with dead people. So in this community, really, a great deal of collective action, even more than in the past these days, is focused on work on the dead or work with the dead. It's not focused on socialist ritual. It's not focused on other kinds of collective projects as it was during the socialist era. It's really, you know, the occasions when people get together to work on their relationships with dead people are the occasions that people get together, are the occasions for collective action of really any kind that transcends the household. So work on the dead has become more and more important in the last couple of decades as other kinds of opportunities for collective action in these regions and in this community anyway have faded away.
One of the things that really stood out to me in this book is that you use sort of a geological metaphor to describe sort of past the relations of past and present rather than a chronological one. You sort of talk about it being more like sort of layers of sedimentation rather than a chronological order. And I was wondering if you could if we could talk about that really quickly before moving into the book more properly. You know, at the risk, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned about putting the cart before the horse, but so your task is to, or the book's task is to excavate these strata, these layers, and describe their mutual influence. Can you sort of talk about how you came to see things in this fashion rather than in sort of a chronological order?
Yeah, absolutely, Tim. So this goes back perhaps to the contrast between the first project that I did in this community and this one. In the first project I did in this community, I organized the project chronologically because it was about the various socialist, it was about the various socialist campaigns that introduced socialism to this community in much the same way it was introduced throughout the rest of China, and then that tried to shape the ways that people related to each other in much the same ways that happened throughout the rest of China. And that chronological ordering, there was something about it that always, I knew it was a compromise from the beginning. And it was a compromise with a kind of what at the time I had found an a kind of impossibility, the impossibility of really trying to organize methodologically a book around the kind of time that it seemed that people were actually living. And so this time, this book, I decided that since the topic was basically ritual and ritualized language, that it was possible to try to make some methodological choices that would draw a little closer to the ways that in this realm, in the realm of ritualized work on the dead, people really seem to make sense to talk about the ways that people seem to be living and expressing themselves and relating to each other and to dead people. So, I mean, if you think about it, like if a part of your life is spent working with people who are dead, then then those like dead people are present in your life. They're really, you know, one's life is a matter of strata in that way. But the methodological choice was to try to understand the ways that in the present, the present ways that people use ritual to communicate with and work with dead people. If you look at those rituals, you can kind of delve down through into them and see the ways that past ritualized forms are present in those rituals. So, you know, one example might be, I won't give examples yet. I think we're going to go through part of the book anyway. So in any case, that was a methodological choice that was trying to do something a little bit different than in my first project, shaped by what I was perceiving of the ways that people were understanding time in this realm of life, this realm of ritualized work for and on dead people.
Initially had sort of been wondering about the specific logic behind the methodology, and that really helps. So I guess now we can sort of talk about the book is generally oriented in or divided into two parts. And you describe part one as having been as being sort of more conventional anthropology of death, describing specific practices associated with this work on the dead from the perspective of the living. And in chapter one, you start with sort of the introduction of writing as a technology into your community and Chinese language inscription on tombstones. Can you talk a little bit more about this, about the Chinese language role in Lolopo work on the dead and sort of when this sort of started and how, I guess?
Yeah, well, it's totally a fascinating topic to me. I'm really interested in this topic. So when I first went to this place, of course, I was looking for difference. it was clear that this community of people was a community that like thought of itself or understood itself to be a kind of community that was a kind of nodal point between what people, the places that people thought their ancestors, or well, the places that people's ancestors came from, that is to say, the places that Lolopo original ancestors came from, which were mountains not too far away, the Ailashan, and the sort of lowland Han communities. It was a kind of place in between. And one of the things that made it a place in between is that people trace their ancestry to all sorts of places. Like as many people in Yunnan do, many people trace their ancestry back to Nanjing. Others trace their ancestry to the Ailashan. And then there were places in Sichuan and other parts of Yunnan that people had immigrated from, and that so that people from many different places were collected into this community. And then I call it a community because not that I'm not trying to put very much weight on that word, but there was a way in which people had developed many kind of ways of doing kinship, ways of doing marriage, ritualized ways of celebrating yearly festivals, ways that kind of tried to bind this place together into a community, all these people from all these different places, right? But when I went to this place, I was looking for difference from Han. And I tended to avoid the things that seemed to be the same as Han. And one of those things was Chinese language writing on tombstones. People didn't use Chinese language in their daily lives. Chinese language writing on tombstones was clearly something, you know, imported from, you know, elsewhere. It was strange to me that, you know, there was so much Chinese language writing on tombstones. I photographed, you know, all the tombstones really, but I wasn't very interested in them. And it was only after gaining some distance that I started to look at these photographs I'd taken and started to really read what was written on the tombstones. And this is really turned out to be a fascinating thing to me. So the one of the things that one learns from reading the tombstones is, first of all, that you asked about the origins of writing on tombstones. One finds that it was, you know, it wasn't until the late 19th or early 20th century that people started to write on tombstones at all. And it was people, families who were trying to maintain a Han identity in a place where maintaining a Han identity was very difficult, that first started writing on tombstones in Chinese language. It was a way to anchor a kind of a Han identity. That and of course, tombstones were also a new invention in the late 19th century, because before that people had burned their dead and put little square rocks over their ashes, you know, kind of buried their ashes in little bags and put little square rocks over their ashes. And then after the late 19th century, people started being influenced by Han immigrants and under a lot of pressure from local officials, started to bury their dead and place tombstones over them. So Lolopo originally simply placed blank tombstones over their dead. Yet those blank tombstones also had an analog inside people's houses that was a blank sheet of paper. And so there was a way, and on that blank sheet of paper was actually, you know, you can't see what's written on that sheet of paper, and that's why I'm calling it blank. But that was the place where you know, various entities from the spirit world wrote the names of the dead and wrote, you know, kind of basically the names of people who were about to die. So that's a very important kind of document inside people's houses that didn't have any writing that one can see on it, but definitely was written. And these blank tombstones were also written in the same way. There was a lot of writing going on even before people started to write in Chinese characters. As you know, throughout this region, writing's an incredibly important kind of idea. So Lopo started burying their dead under blank tombstones, and then gradually they picked up the idea of writing on tombstones from these small families clinging to Han identity. And then in the early 20th century and then the mid 20th century, they developed their own way of writing on tombstones in Chinese. So they gradually elaborated to a far greater extent than any of their Han neighbors, and as in my knowledge, to a greater extent than most, you know, most tombstones, Han tombstones in the region. They elaborated ways of writing tombstones. So you know, they ended up writing, of course, in some of the writing was of course names and dates of the dead. And then people started to write names of the dead's descendants, names of the descendants, large groups of descendants. Some tombstones have as many as 80 names of descendants. And then they started to write eulogies or biographies for the dead on the stones. And then nostalgic poetry about socialism and revolution on tombstones as well. So that tombstones eventually started, you know, there wasn't enough space on the stone to do all of this. So they divided tombstones into three. They put three stones over every tomb. Of course, every tomb included, you know, two coffins because people were always buried in pairs, conjugal pairs. But so, you know, tombstones became more and more elaborate as time evolved, and they're becoming more elaborate now. One of the things that's happening now is that people as they write the names of the descendants of dead people, they're writing the names of descendants, all of the descendants, even those whom no one has heard of for years and years, those who are dead, those who've just disappeared, gone away, gone to the city, and have their own, you know, families in the city and are not communicating back. Tombstones are important now because they're a place where all of, you know, the descendants of a dead person or people who make themselves into a kind of community of related people around a dead person, where all of those people are gathered in a way that they can't gather in the present because there's been so much dispersal and so much diaspora.
It's really fascinating. The whole questions of language, particularly in these areas of Southwest China, is really, really interesting. Just as a curious side note, are the Lulupo one of the communities that sort of has these folk tales about how they used to have the technology of writing, but one of their ancestors ate it?
Yes, indeed. I mean, yes, of course. So their version of this is they were given writing by a teacher along with a Han person and a Tibetan person, and the Han person was rich and could afford paper and wrote the writing down on paper. The Tibetan person wrote, I think, if I'm remembering this right, wrote the writing down on another medium. I'm thinking hide or skin or something, but maybe that's not right. But anyway, it was also preserved. And the Lulupo folk, were poor, of course, but they were rich enough to have buckwheat pancakes, which is the kind of a traveling food. So they wrote it all down on a buckwheat pancake, but on the way home, of course, they got hungry and ate it. So they have writing. It's just that they don't write it. in Lolopo language, one has writing if one is kind of trained as a ritualist. You know, it's just that one has it in one's body and in one's stomach. And you can say it from there instead of having to look at a piece of paper, which in their view really limits what you can do.
Oh, I love sort of the way that some of these tales travel too. Fantastic. So the remainder of part one sort of looks at, and this is sort of chapters 2, 3, and 4, look at how the Lolopo see, how they see bodies and souls, how sacrifices and exchanges create a formal image of an entire social world even. And also ending off, and you round off part one with sort of a chapter on the art of the lament. And I was wondering if you could sort of talk about how these function together in the Lolopo work on the dead.
I was recently reading an interview with Eduardo Viveros de Castro. And in this interview, he said, you know, it seems like every anthropologist has their sort of originary ethnographic moment. And, you know, Marilyn Sothern's ethnographic moment was it. Everything happens as though one guy is handing another guy a conch shell, you know, in Sothern's work. So, you know, that's of course amusing and maybe not accurate at all, and perhaps a little bit, you know, insulting of Sothern. But I was thinking about that in regard to this book, and I thought, well, you know, if there's an ethnographic moment like that's kind of unwinds itself in this particular book, it's the moment in which I'm allowed to go to a funeral. So one of the things about funerals in this place is that they're quite private in a sense. They're gatherings of an entire community, yet people do have in the present some concern that outsiders will criticize them. And that's a valid concern. It's a concern that was built up over, you know, a history of criticism from the outside, you know, and a history that includes terrible things, and that includes the suppression of all ritual during the 60s and 70s. And when I was first taken to a funeral, I was basically sent away. I had with me another outsider, a research assistant, I guess, or a spy, a peitong, somebody that was sent along by my unit to take care of me. And the people who were hosting the funeral said, you know, you guys, if you're going to be here, you have to kneel on the ground and knock your head before my grandfather, the dead person, or else you can leave. And my assistant, who was a E person himself, not exactly from that place, but from a place nearby, said, you know, basically, this is an insult. We have to leave immediately. There's no way I'm going to kowtow to anybody's ancestors, and you shouldn't either. I was all ready to do it. I was like, okay. Later, I was made part of a family and was, and as part of a family, I participated in funerals as a matter of course, and was told what to bring and was told how to interact with people, and everything worked out quite well. And I ended up at many, many funerals. Even though during this, my first field work, you know, I wasn't really that interested in funerals. Still, just to be a person, I had to do it over and over and over again. So all of this is just to say, well, perhaps the ethnographic moment for this book is standing confused in this courtyard crowded with people, sometimes hundreds of people, with an enormous hubbub going on. Sometimes with this, you know, terrible instrument called a suona, this double reed instrument, wailing away, often with it not, you know, because it's expensive to hire somebody to do that, but with people lamenting, you know, wailing themselves, with people laughing and shouting, with an enormous amount of exchange going on of, you know, people cutting up rice cakes, killing goats, cutting up goats, passing rice cakes around, a guy at the head of the coffin, a guy at the head of a coffin barking orders at everybody, cutting up more rice cakes, people bringing grain, bags of grain to this guy, grain flowing around, rice cakes flowing around, kids wandering around, running around, just, and all of this going on, and people saying all sorts of stuff, and trying to, just being in this moment and trying to understand any bit of it, you know, just being confused by every single bit of it, time after time after time. I think that kind of bewilderment is my ethnographic moment for this book. So these chapters of this book basically try to unwind something about what a funeral is supposed to be doing. It was clearly and remains clearly an incredibly important thing to be doing. And to the extent that, you know, every dead person is not given just one funeral, but many. You're given a funeral 3 days after or so days after you die. You're given another one, another big one, in the first lunar 10th month after you die. You're given another one, after your spouse dies, and another one in the first, lunar 10th month after she dies or he dies. Another one is given in a couple of decades later. And these are all really big events. And this is not mentioning the small ones, because there are many small ceremonies also that are given to, performed for, given to the dead, you know, places where people gather together to, as we were saying before, work on the dead. And so these chapters basically try to unspool some of that and try to show what it is that people are actually doing, and to show some of the quite elaborate and really, in my view, lovely poetic work that's going on, as people do what they're doing, basically tries to unwind the quite elaborate techniques that people are engaging in. It's a very developed, elaborate, complicated technology that people are engaging in, a technology for imaging relations amongst people, a technology for of knowledge that gathers what's known about people's relations to each other and to the dead, and displays them all in one place at one time. And a technology that transforms dead people from dangerous ghostly entities to powerful, stable, anchored ancestors. And that's those three chapters are really all about those different kinds of technologies.
Brilliant. Yeah. I love particularly how you sort of talk about the work of the lament in particular. But then following this, in part two, you examine the great chants at the center of two ritual events, the 10th month sacrifice and one that you call sleeping in the forest. As a folklorist, I love how you use these chants to create a sort of a grounded theory of Lolopo work with and on the dead. And I guess you sort of begin this half of the book first with some ethical and methodological questions to your acquisition of the chants. That's something that really interested me, that you sort of put this as its own chapter. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of these questions, but also the motivation for putting it into its own chapter.
So the second part of this book is about two very similar, quite long ritual chants. Basically, the biggest part of that buckwheat pancake that was given to Lolopo ancestors and that they ate, and that skilled ritualists before liberation and in the early 1950s would say at two events, an event that was held for people, held for dead people in the 10th lunar month, the year that they died. And then a second event that was held a couple of generations later. And these chants were, my interlocutors in Juzo, this community, many of them remembered these chants and thought of them as the kind of repository of all valuable knowledge about dead people, but also about the world in general. And this, by the time I did fieldwork here, was of course colored with a sense that Lolopo were an ethnicity now, and so it started to be a matter of kind of ethnic pride, I suppose. Like, so I think people might, you know, put it as all Lolopo knowledge about the world, but in a sense that meant the same thing: all valuable knowledge about the world and about dead people. Ancient knowledge that was passed down from ancestors. Knowledge that, because it was passed down from ancestors, was powerful. Yet, the people who held this knowledge and were able to speak it disappeared, had disappeared by the time I did fieldwork in this place. They, first of all, I should say that being able to say these two chants was an extraordinary kind of accomplishment. I can't imagine it. These are very long and quite elaborate chants. We don't do this kind of thing anymore. Even those of us who are paid to be intellectuals are incapable of memorizing something that is supposed to be said the same way every time, and that takes, you know, a long time to say. I mean, you know, hours and hours to say at a very rapid clip. So this was an extraordinary accomplishment, and not everybody was up to the task. A few people were trained to do this by their teachers, and they disappeared, you know, over time. Some of them, well, basically, I think the story can be just said simply that after these two rituals were forbidden, after people started to be persecuted for being for having been ritualists who, you know, cheated the people. I'm quoting, cheated the people by tricking them into, you know, paying them to do this kind of thing. I mean, they weren't paid much. They were paid like a goat. But after that happened, then these ritualists all ended up, you know, dying because of physical persecution during the Cultural Revolution, or dying because the spirits that gave them the capacity to remember and perform these chants, being dissatisfied that they no longer performed these chants, you know, made them ill and killed them. They were all dead in any case, and I was told repeatedly that they were all dead. And so, and that was fine with me. I mean, I really had no interest in this kind of old stuff. I was interested in socialism and what was going on in the present and the recent past. And this kind of old stuff was really, you know, similar kinds of, similar, I had the sense that similar oral literature had been collected by teams of ethnographers in China in the 50s. And, you know, it was basically written in translation and was available. And so I really didn't have any interest, very much interest. But eventually, one of the folks who had made me their own project, there were many different kinds, not many, but several different kinds of people who made me their own project. And one kind thought that I should really be working on funerals and funeral rituals, which I didn't care that much about initially. One of those folks basically made a discovery that a cousin of his or a cousin of his wife had been one of the skilled ritual practitioners who could perform these chants. And he lived still in a village that was, you know, a day's walk away or so. And he had fled there during the 50s. And he had missed much of the difficulties of the Cultural Revolution. He was living in this place, high mountain place, farming buckwheat. These places existed quite well for a while by farming hemp and buckwheat and cutting trees before all that became, you know, unprofitable. And my friend suggested that we go visit this guy. So we did, and I was kind of carried along by his enthusiasm. And we went and we negotiated with this chap to allow us to record these two chants. And I really didn't have much of a good control over the situation or a very good sense of what was going on. My friend did most of the negotiating. I ended up paying this guy a few hundred yuan to record his chants. And his condition was that he was living with the spirit that had allowed him, gave him the power to say these chants, and that this spirit was making him sick for decades repeatedly because he was unable to perform this chant in context. He was able to continue, he was able to say it because every year he did perform it at least once for this spirit in order to appease this spirit, yet that didn't work very well because it wasn't actually in the right kind of context. It wasn't during a funeral. And his wife was adamantly opposed to his doing this because she knew it made him sick. And so we ended up getting this chant from this guy and taking it basically in the form of a recording and paying him for it. And then, you know, well, I came back a few years later and he had died, and he had died, my friend. It became clear to me that many people believe that he had died in part because of my interaction with him. So obviously this has been something that's troubled me for a long time. And really, this book was written as a way to deal with that trouble, I guess. And so I wanted to be as honest as I could in this chapter about just what that interaction was, without really trying to justify it or say that it was, or have a kind of theory of how I was or wasn't being ethical, but just trying to say what was going on and what had happened. And since then, I've had these recordings, and after this man who, I give a pseudonym in this book, the pseudonym is Li Bizhong. After this man died, there was nobody else who had this huge chunk of the buckwheat cake except me in the form of recordings. I made several attempts to distribute recordings. I would distribute them to ritualists I knew, along with tape recorders. Eventually I distributed CDs to people who had sons or nephews who had computers. None of that really seemed to work very well. The tape recordings, I found some of them in the county town and the cultural bureau, sort of locked up in a display case, because they'd been basically confiscated and made part of culture, and preserved as part of culture, and no one was listening to them. And others were burned when the ritualists I gave to them had died. They were burned with their belongings, along with the rest of their belongings, in an exorcism. So I knew I had to do something with them, and writing the last part of this book was an attempt to, work out the trouble, to try to make these recordings of this chant live in some way that was not just in a desk drawer of my own. Obviously it's not doing, I mean, obviously it's just a book in English. I mean, it's kind of pitiful. I hope that I can at some point put the recordings up on a website that everyone, any Lolopo person could gain access to, in such a way that would work out and that scholars could gain access to as well. But for the moment, this book is what I've got.
Incredible. This is so many of these questions are things I think many of us grapple with, although the specific circumstances are almost undoubtedly different. But all of us working in China and doing interview work and collecting culture, as it were, I think this will be really valuable to all of us, to sort of help us think through these questions as well. So thank you. I guess really quickly, I was wondering if you could just maybe in the briefest of terms, I'm sort of cognizant of your time, but sort of take us through sort of then the remainder of part two, which to sort of how these chants tell us about personal relations between the dead and the kin, or how they help us understand this work on the Lolopo work on the dead.
Yeah. So three chapters of this book explore these chants. They were really fun to write. And they were very challenging to write. Just transcribing and translating the chants was a very long and difficult process. Trying to understand them, trying to find a way to represent them was a difficult process, because they're like many other forms of what one might call oral literature. They're constructed to be embodied. I mean, they're really constructed to be made part of one's body, and to be expressed from or emit from the body, and so they have embodied characteristics. They have a lot of repetition. They are modular. So they basically are broken into these modular kind of chunks that are called songs. They're broken into many of those songs, and then each song has a kind of introduction and conclusion that's the same as every other song, and then there's a part in between that's different. And they have a lot of parallelism in them as well, and that's also one of the characteristics of oral poetry. Parallelism of many kinds that connects verses to verses, that connects songs to songs, that spread throughout the whole structure. There is a structure. The structure unfolds the creation of the world. And then it unfolds a kind of theory of what dead souls are, and then it unfolds a kind of theory of what dead bodies are. It's uh, I I learned to look at this chant as what it. So one of the things that that became clear to me in my interaction with Li Bizhong and also other ritualists who remembered these chants and who knew a lot about how to do this stuff was that, you know, the chants were really nothing unless they were performed in the presence of dead people. They were dialogues with dead people. And they created their own specific kind of really world of interrelation between dead people and living people. And I learned to look at them as an effort to make this world of interaction, to make it vibrant, to put it into speech, to reel it out in speech, in dialogue with every dead person who had died, as a way to transform dead people, you know, to continue the work that was transforming, you know, dead people into ancestors, but also as a way to part of the transformation was really creating a world of interaction, a world that dead people inhabited and that inhabited in part in relation to living people. So I learned to do that. So I divided the chant into three parts, a part that was about the creation of this world, and a part that was about the soul of the dead, and a part that was about the body of the dead. And one of the things I learned was that as the chant unfolded was that really this world of interaction was a world in which there were all these analogs, and that these analogs, that is to say, all sorts of analogs with what might be called what throughout the book I call a dead body, and that in the end I learned that the earth itself is an analog to the dead body, that it's understood in this chant, in this interaction between dead and living people that the chant does, it's understood as a dead body, a dead body on which all sorts of work has been done, that, you know, another analog of a dead body is, you know, a construction made out of sticks and little animals and leaves and all sorts of other stuff, very explicitly meant to be a dead person's body. There are all sorts of other analogs. You know, the valley that these people live in too can be considered as a dead body in the same way. So working on this chant, working on this chant taught me a kind of understanding of this. A certain way of thinking about and working on the world itself that was all about working on dead bodies. So in the end, it turns out that working on a dead body is not just working on a specific dead person, that there's all sorts of ways in which it's about living in the world and working on the world itself.
It's such a great way to approach sort of these Lolopo ways of understanding their work on the dead. And wow. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time here. And I want to thank you again for giving so much of your time, because it is really, it's just been a really fascinating conversation. I've been really delighted to be able to talk with you. But before we let you go, I was wondering if you'd be willing to tell me a little bit about what you're working on now.
Right now, I'm trying to understand an archive, really. It's an archive that was discovered by a linguist named Ma Xue Liang, who was sent by his teachers to two counties in northern Yunnan, Luchuan and Wuding, to collect manuscripts in one of the six scripts that we now call e-scripts. This was known at the time as Loho or Lowu, in Chinese Lowu, and in local language Loho, Luho script. And Ma Xue Liang eventually made his way to the hereditary house of of a or Luhol hereditary chief. So, as you know, in many parts of Western China, local governance happened through a kind of indirect form of indirect governance, in which at the very local level, native hereditary chiefs basically were allowed to have a certain kind of local power and to inherit that power. So he ended up in the house of this chief, and he found. And this was in the 40s, and there was one woman living in this house along with, you know, her servants and just call them servants. And she showed him her archive, which was a stone room that contained the genealogical records and the records, the legal records and the records of reporting to the magistrate, the county, the prefectural magistrate of her lineage of chiefs. And these chiefs are the Na dynasty, I guess you would say, of chiefs who held power under a great deal of pressure from under the regime that we call I'm trying to remember what we call it in English, but under a regime in which chiefs were basically demoted and controlled, and in any case, they'd held power in that region. And so there many of these records are in Chinese, and they're really, really interesting. And many of the records are in the e-script, and they're incredibly interesting as well. And I'm just trying to understand what this archive is, both parts of it. If you would say both languages, there are many parts, many kind of different kinds of documents, but the documents in both languages, and to try to really be able to say something about what the life of this house was, of this incredibly important house that was the center of this region, and to say something about how it worked across two languages, across different forms of, sort of local authority, across chiefs who were trying to be kind of Confucian officials in relation to their superiors at the prefectural level, and traditional sort of rulers, I guess traditional, if you will, sort of rulers in relation to their subjects, and negotiating this very, very difficult kind of position. I'm just trying to understand how that works.
It sounds really fascinating, Eric. I'm really excited to start seeing some of the conclusions you come to. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'd like to thank you. So thanks very much for being on, and take care.
Thanks, Tim. It was a lot of fun.